Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
From the, I call it the chief vehicle officer, but the lead designer for the new Mach-E. And there's one thing that he kind of dropped. I think this was 2 days ago. And he said, you know, if there's one thing we're very proud of, and this goes back to the comment of Akio Toyoda, when in his earnings call, he was asked twice. And on the second time, you know, the first time he referred to Elon Musk as a great chef. And then he referred to the rest of the industry, though, that everyone has a recipe and everyone has kitchens. So when he was asked again, he says, again, he goes, I think he is a good chef, but does he have a recipe to mass produce and does he have kitchens? Because we have many kitchens and we have a great recipe for mass production. What they've seen when they've seen quality problems with the Tesla vehicle, it's typically those vehicles built during end of cycles where he needs to get a certain output to hit a certain number of vehicles made. And when that happens, your quality comes down. Not in essence, the rest of the auto manufacturers, they've been used to high volume production for a long time.
Right.
So when someone says to me, well, Tesla's a tech company, they're still a manufacturing company, right? So I thought what was very interesting from the chief vehicle officer for the Mach-E was he said, you know, if there's one thing you don't have to worry about, you know, your roof isn't going to come peeling off when you go through a car wash, your door handles aren't going to freeze over. He made these comments, but he didn't say who he was speaking of, right? And Tesla could very easily come back and make comments to say, well, we have longer range, we have this, we have that. And I think those are things that are going to come amongst the industry, right? Like right now, they've done a good job of being able to figure out how to monetize the data, use it to improve quality as well. But a lot of that's going to come, and you're still a manufacturer. Now, I know from a topic standpoint, how does this relate to, say, security? The idea that the hot topic for CES for the last number of years has been autonomous vehicles, and all the tech companies have been wanting to get in to work with the autos. And a lot of the tech companies, including Amazon, Google, Apple, Microsoft, all looked at, we need to be making vehicles. And the second they realized the amount of capital investment needed and what the profit returns are in automotive, it's no secret, it's almost dead last in profitability in the 10 largest industries. They were like, there's no way. Their shareholders would look at that and say, we're going to go from 50 to 100% profit margins down to 5%. Like, this is ridiculous. And look at all that capital investment. But they could play a big game in being involved in the tech that's inside the vehicle, right? But when you look at the idea of supply chain, and it's something that the automakers, you know, from the standpoint of they used to have over 400 suppliers for any one vehicle. And they said, you know what? We need to trim that down to be able to manage it better, to manage our quality, to manage our production cycles, et cetera. And then several of these automakers share suppliers. And what does this sound very eerily familiar to? When we talk about what recently hit in the news with SolarWinds is the idea that now you have a supplier, just like could be a bolt supplier that supplies bolts to almost every OE, Volkswagen, Honda, Toyota, et cetera. Now you have a company that supplies a certain product, a nut and a bolt, for instance, that's extremely valuable to everybody. And you've been using it for years, that same bolt, very good. And now something happens, somebody got in with the bolt supplier, and you've witnessed what could be the biggest supply chain attack in the history of cyber.
Absolutely. And I think there's so many different places we can go with this discussion, you know, from, you know, the reliance on single sourcing for so many people to how do we where did we break down and how do we do better at the supply chain management or the security of our supply chain? I know we all love those question lists that we get and give. And I think it's karma. Every time we have to answer one is payback for one that we sent somebody. I think there's technical questions, there's detection questions. There's a whole lot of things that we can bring into this great security debate. But first, just want to introduce, I'm Dan Ayala, along with Eric Willey and Brian Schneebly. Welcome to, episode 14. Yeah, it's no secret. Everybody in technology, everybody in security is talking about SolarWinds, and we're going to too. Not one
jumping on the bandwagon,
not one to be left behind. There's no FOMO here. So Brian, I think that's a great, it's a great opening on, you know, on how we got here and some of the risks.
Let me ask real quick. I know there's so many different news places covering so many different angles to the story, so much information that we still don't know. Have we heard anything, any ideas around the initial entry point and how they got into SolarWinds to get this into the code? Or is that still kind of an unknown?
I've not yet heard.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I think it's more speculation.
Because I go back and I can't help but to remember what Brian was talking about. And we were talking about the different ownership and different security companies that have changed over the time that perfectly timed themselves out with COVID and everybody goes to work from home and begin to wonder. And granted, I'm taking certain leaps here. If it's going to come out at the end of this, that we're going to find out there was some element from work from home that ended up playing into this, that all of a sudden security possibly became more lax because you had a distribution of people that still had to work on software to push that out. And because it got lax, it created an entry point into SolarWinds.
Now, Eric, don't go prematurely destroying the best thing that's happened to, if I can't see you, I can't, you're not, must not be working. because we really need to move away from that, from a working style. But your point is really well made. You know, it introduced a very rapid change in working styles, and one that most technology and security organizations were not prepared for. We didn't spend the time, we didn't have all of those infrastructures ready to just pivot everybody home in a day. It's possible.
I'm definitely not advocating against the work from home. You know, this as kind of I'll say a leader in the technology space, I do not believe in the metric of time in seat or button seat being a good metric to track productivity. We have metrics. We know how to track productivity. It doesn't matter if you're in the office or if you're at home, we can still track those metrics.
So Eric, though, to your point though, when something happens, right? And you take COVID, for example, the immediate shift to work from home created a need for, if you want to call it digital transformation, but tools so that people could work from home. So IT was worrying about, you know, are you on a WebEx, Zoom, Teams? Like what platform can we get, you know, so that everybody can still communicate? Then the security teams were worrying about, you know, that perimeter being down. But at no point was anyone talking about the supply chain in terms of, is my weakest link actually not the fact that the perimeter just went down, but that something's been in the supply chain. And when they go back and talk about dates, and several dates have been thrown out, going all the way back to June of last year, and then August maybe of last year, but they definitely know by October of last year that there was an entry point. You know, where was it done? How was it done? Was it that exact timing? And now the fact that there's been four different malware families found, you know, two that are believed not to be working in conjunction, that being, you know, the Solar Burst and the Supernova, but then you take the other two families. Again, I pivot back to the idea of Sun Tzu, right? Like the whole idea of art of war. And if you look at what the principles are, and one is planning, and they've talked about this extensively, there was obviously a lot of planning that went into this. And then character, you know, alliances, deception, but using advantages is one of them. And with the work from home, talk about a big advantage. You know, Eric, you said when this hand over here is waving, what's the other hand doing?
Right.
Right. Everybody's focused over here. And of course, there was an uptick in ransomware. And that seemed to be on everybody's plate and top of mind, top of conversation. Meanwhile, this definitely wasn't an actor, threat actor looking to ransom. This was espionage.
Right.
This was looking at information, seeing communication, emails, being able to look at financials, at least from the list that have been populated so far, right? The U.S. Department of Treasury. To be able to look at everything going on during COVID to really understand where maybe there's weak points in a financial system is massive tactical advantage.
Oh, yeah. And again, this is all speculative, right? It's we're still too early into the analysis to figure out what the actual entry point is, but I'm 100% with you from that point. And I think there's a little bit of onus on, you know, I'll say me, the consumer, the customer, right? Because if this does come out that it was a work from home element that kind of played into this, well, there's certain expectations customers have. You know, if you look at Brian, the company you work for and some of the security companies that we deal with, are amazing now at turning out features at such a fast rate. My expectation is every IT company has the capability to do that. SolarWinds would not be exempt from that. So even though we're all going through this paradigm of shifting businesses, where are people working from? My expectation is you're still maintaining your updates. I'm still getting fixes for bugs that are coming out. That doesn't get to change. So you better figure that out quickly. And there's good chances. There's a lot of companies out there that took some shortcuts to maintain some operability during these times.
Yeah. Contracts are contracts. SLAs are SLAs. And you better know how to meet them. And I think one of the best byproducts of this whole thing, of both COVID and the SolarWinds issue, is I think it's going to create a new focus on the two other parts that make up information security, where we often lose sight. For those of you listening that don't know, we often talk about security in three parts: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. These three things: confidentiality being how do we keep things secret, how do we keep things making sure that only the people that need it should access it. Integrity: how do we make sure the data and information that is stored is not corrupted along the way, whether it's in transit or at rest. And availability: how do we make sure systems are there when you need them, that the data and information and access are there when you need it? People immediately think about confidentiality when it comes to security, but oftentimes the integrity and availability parts are missed. They're not as strong of a focus in either CIO's minds, in business, in the rest of the organization's mind, and oftentimes in security practitioners as well. And I think that these two things, COVID and SolarWinds, both really shine a very bright flashlight on integrity and availability and the need to refocus on those topics as security practitioners and as businesses. You know, it's easy to say, oh, sure, I'll accept that risk. We'll only put one data center up and we'll put a very tiny cold standby that'll take us 3 days to spin up if we need it. Okay, now name that tune. Now you have to go do that. Does that really meet what your customers are expecting? Back to your point, Eric.
Yeah, this is interesting. And I begin to wonder if this breaks up, because I know there's always been an underlying thought at some point. You know, we've thrown out the phrase, nobody gets fired for buying Cisco, right? Cisco's a good company, it's reliable. And granted, Cisco has nothing to do with this, but you think about there's a certain element of choosing products that a lot of big or bigger named companies that have higher security demands buy. And there's almost this sense of security just because, well, if they went through the vetting process, if they chose them, then therefore I'm also safe. Does right. SolarWinds now change that thinking process for us?
Does it make the and I'll use the older term, two guys in a garage, does the smaller, less mature, less everybody's got them ubiquitous choice? I think it makes them, I think they've always been appealing, but I tend to be at organizations where there's an interest in using a little more bleeding edge. But no, I think you're right on, Eric. I think there will be some interest, some increased interest in diversifying. Then the other question is, do I diversify within my own organization and not just use one tool for right. everything?
So one thing I want to throw out, because I think you guys have definitely touched on it. And Dan, when we were talking from the automotive side, if you think about an example where a supplier who used to be one of the biggest, all right, Takata, right? Airbags. Today, Takata doesn't exist. And what happened there? Where was the fall from grace? And you mentioned some very large tech companies. And when you get that big, almost anybody in the automotive industry, if you're going to buy an airbag, was like, Takata was the name, right? And in the last 10 years, there have been prime examples where in order to cut corners, to increase profitability, different automakers have not only relaxed from a quality standard or quality control aspect, that they can show that different testing, yeah, we trim that testing down lead time wise, we trim this down, we trim that down, all in an effort to reduce cost, increase production to hit numbers, right? And as you grow larger, and I called this out maybe about a year ago, when, and this has nothing to do with our product, the company I work for, but in terms of an update on a product we were using, and whatever system it was we were using from a sales function and a accounting function. And there was this big change to it. And I actually shot a note in, kind of in my sense, I didn't think I was slamming it, but I was using automotive terminology. I said, you know, this is so, in my opinion, typical of a software company pushing something out without testing it. And then it doesn't work. And here I am for 3 days trying to figure out how to use it. This doesn't happen in automotive. You know, you crash the car because this broke, people get sued, you know? And I mean, we talk about some slack. I got my VP called me and was like, hey, Brian, you can't send an email like that. You know, this team worked really hard on that. And I offline was like, no, I get it. I didn't think I was being that offensive. Right. And he's like, yeah, go back and read what you wrote. And I'm like, but it's true. Like, you pushed something out and you didn't test it. And now you look at
beta culture.
We talked about this, the Phoenix project.
Right.
The idea, there is this whole production side to IT now in every organization, you know, when it comes to DevOps, you build things. And how do we test those out to make sure that, you know, your S3 buckets are configured correctly, or this is done correctly, right? Just from a hygiene standpoint, how do you know that the companies you're buying products from are doing that correctly? You know, we talked about PFMEA, DFMEA. I don't think the automotive industry is who you turn to say, hey, teach us how to make sure we're doing it correct, because it's a different beast, right? But there's some similarities in terms of responsibility and onus placed on when you're producing something and you're that large. Takata doesn't exist today because when they found out that these airbags were blowing up and information was held, they got burned to the ground. The governments across the world made them not only pay up, they did it in such a way that that company wasn't going to exist.
Right.
And I can't help but look at the number of, when we talk about vulnerabilities, et cetera, and people talk about Patch Tuesday. I didn't even know what Patch Tuesday was until I started working for Sentinel One. I knew of Taco Tuesday, and it was quite popular.
It's a good Tuesday.
It's a great Tuesday.
And now you get four of them as opposed to only one Patch Tuesday.
But you look at, and I get the updates, you know, where people post on LinkedIn about, oh, just so you know, this wasn't patched, there's a vulnerability here. And just so we see active this going on. From a production side, I understand that there's going to be times where something was built, didn't know about this vulnerability, et cetera. But like you said, when timelines are being short, you're being pushed. And Eric, there's expectations that, well, you release so many features. Our expectation is those features are just going to be coming out monthly or weekly. Right. You know what I mean? And we set that expectation very high, and at the cost of gaining more and more business and never losing business. I mean, I hate to say it. People look at the revenue and the profits and everything else and say, hey.
Yeah, I definitely see the parallel being drawn there. You know, in the Takata's case, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe it ended up being deemed gross negligence, right? They knew about it and still hit it. I think we're still too early to know if that existed in the SolarWinds case. But certainly, I mean, it sounded like they were testing the features that came out, the bugs they were fixing, but they missed an added feature that somebody put there on their behalf. So that becomes very, very interesting on how we see this play out. You know, this is actually an area I've been thinking about for a couple of years now. As I think about, you know, we're going into vulnerability management, patch management in general. How many companies have actually taken a look at where are you getting your patches from? You know, a lot of big companies run SCCM. SCCM is great for getting things out there. It doesn't give you the patches. You still got to pull them from somewhere, some catalog. And, you know, there's some big Shavlik. Actually, I think they got bought out now. There's some big players in that space. But I know of a lot of companies that use, go back to that, Dan, what you said, a guy in his basement, right? That it's a Microsoft expert or somebody that did this once at a company that writes patches. Ivante, yeah, that's right. Somebody who writes patches and for a low value will give you those patches already bundled up so you can push them out. And I begin to wonder, and I've thought about this for a while, if that is going to be another attack vector, because that's essentially what happened through SolarWinds. It was a trusted mechanism, right? And it was embedded in a patch that needed to fix some bugs that people were dealing with that had added code to it. Do we start seeing that on the broader ecosystem in some of the patches that come out through traditional patch management?
But Eric, and I think you're right, but I think the problem that we're hearing in SolarWinds is this actually comes even deeper. This is about understanding internal code potentially. And when changes are made from the trusted source, this is like, again, how do I trust the antivirus update that I'm getting, right, or the EDR update that I'm getting that's coming from a trusted source and is signed? I mean, the updates were signed with this code embedded in it. So all of the traditional mechanisms that we've used to ensure that we're downloading the right thing, even if you were doing an MD5 checksum on this thing, and looked at the, it would match because it was right, what was issued. The integrity was there of the data coming out. The problem was that the source of it was where the corruption. So they've actually gotten, you know, if you go to the root, the core of the apple is where the festering began.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I think it'd be hard pressed to put any of this on the customer base at all, that we should have caught it, that there was something there. I mean, if we look at it, we've talked about for a long time about malware being there that does really infrequent beacons. And, you know, Brian, I forget, you pointed us to a really great, or a couple great articles that were kind of breaking this down. But if I'm correct, the beacon was, there was a pretty big time lapse from when it actually called out, right?
Yeah, no, there was. And again, I think that goes back to when you look at the preparation, right, and the timing and the planning behind it. There was definitely some coordination there. And also the thought process too, before something executes, to make sure to wait a certain amount of time, right? Because just like some of the security products out there, when it comes to threat data versus the telemetry data, right, and the amount of time that certain companies keep that data becomes valuable. So now, even if you were saying 90 days, what is 90 days when this goes back months, almost a year, right?
Right. I mean,
the visibility.
And at the end of the day, what it tells me is that we need to rethink not just the supply chain from third parties, but our own internal pipeline for development and assurance of quality development, you know, and at the risk of turning this into the manufacturing greater than all others episode of the Great Security Debate, this is something that physical manufacturing has had in hand for a long time. I do not come out of automotive, but I come out of pharma. And this idea of, you know, this idea of manufacturing quality is one that is equally as well embedded in that everything has levels of tests, that code is, you know, that all technology and code, every line is accounted for. And when something changes, it needs to be looked at as to why. And I think that these levels of rigor, which are 180 degrees orthogonal to that of agile development, are going to become more necessary. And this is, you know, this is like telling the emperor he's not wearing any clothes, but there's going to need to be some changes to code, release, and then figure it out.
Right. I think the snapback from the consumer side, the customer side is going to end up being what we're talking about. It's going to make it into questionnaires. And now we're going to ask deeper questions about these customers. it would have never, I don't think it would have ever ferreted this out.
Secure code development? Yes,
exactly. Outside of somebody going through the bigger, we're going to bring out an outside firm to actually audit the controls, right? As you get into your, what the SSAE team is now the SSAE.
It's SOC 2.
SSAE 18. The SOC 1, SOC 2, and actually going through and attesting that, okay, the controls are in place, and now we're going to actually test that the controls are being adhered to. Outside of that, I don't think any questionnaire would have ever caught anything like this. Now, a bunch of companies, I think, are going to respond, and that's what they're going to do. They're going to broaden the scope of their questionnaire, and it's still not going to change the landscape.
No, it won't. It won't at all, because one, the questionnaires are answered by, they are subjectively answered, and they're like RFPs. And no offense to people who fill out RFPs. I fill out plenty myself for companies I do work for and with, and you give the answers. You give the truth, but it's not detailed. It's not comprehensive. It's broad. It's generalized. And it, you know, you have four lines before you lose the reader altogether. Same thing on the security questionnaires. You just don't have it's not the right vehicle to answer and say, on these four systems, we don't do this, but on these three systems, we do. It just doesn't, it's not the right thing. And companies look at their code as intellectual property and are unwilling to release it to suppliers to customers to be able to do their own inspection on it, because that's their secret sauce. That's the crown jewels. So does this create a market for a third party set of independent companies to do this assessment? The last thing I want to do is create another certification regime.
Right.
But I think there needs to be something trusted where I can give my code. I can give my, an ongoing, not just snapshot, ongoing, so that I can get a continuous inside view. And I'm not talking about this outside in view, you know, where we look at the network from the internet and say, here are the four machines we think you own. But rather, you know, in partnership with people as a way to start to overcome this.
It almost sounds like you're talking about holding current version of code in escrow and then doing a diff on it and understanding where changes come into play.
What each change is. Yeah. And it's not escrow from a release perspective, if my company goes bankrupt perspective, but right. But an escrow in the form of, I'm a trusted holder of it and I'm doing these services on it and I report on
good.
It. Yeah, exactly.
The one thing I'd say there though is like when you mention a third party, right? And I look at, and again, pivoting back to automotive, right? And crash testing ratings that come out in third party where they test a vehicle, give it a crash test rating, right? If you get a really bad crash test rating, you know, if someone's going to go out and buy your vehicle, it's like, well, that one got a 1 and that one got a 5. You know, if you got a family of 3, are you buying the 1 or the 5, right? But then, and we've talked about this before, but there's a lot of third-party validation companies out there, but they accept money from the people that are doing the validation.
Right.
Right. So almost everybody got an award who participated. Each award was given a different name. And then if you make that a government responsibility, when you talk about features being pushed out in a timely manner, now I feel like you'd be into the automotive days where it's 2 years until the next, you know, or 3 years for the minor model change, or 5 years.
According to the car stereo in mind, it's still that way.
And I'm not saying that government slows down that process, but again, I don't know the best way to look at it, but I think from the idea internally, when you look at how you produce something, whether it's lines of code, a finished good, an injection mold, some type of pharma, even the idea of the term red rabbit, right? And it's a coined term for, it was used by the KGB and even the CIA. And the red rabbit is just, it's a fake, right? That you put out there and see if they grab it. And the same thing that you do in an assembly line, you run a red rabbit through with a known defect to see if the production control mechanisms you have in place catch it, right? And I think there needs to be a level of, when I say red rabbits, when you run through from a supply standpoint, if you're in the supply chain providing tech, when we're testing, we're not just testing that the product works, but also that the product's secure. and the idea of running red rabbits through it, do the mechanisms we have in place catch the fact that if somebody did this, that we catch it? And if the answer is no, then how do we catch it?
So I'm with you there. And I think from a code release standpoint, you could do that, right? I don't necessarily think that that would give us any greater sense of security that the underlying code itself is good, but that the process to push code to test it is that process is sound. You know, I like the automotive example, but I kind of feel as we talk about physical objects in the automotive realm, that they're the quantitative method being used on those, the understanding of data around it, how long a part can stay in existence before it breaks down. What's my average number of defects per X number of parts? We are great at quantifying that because the lives are on the line. We have to quantify that. I think it's much, much tougher though when we get into the software realm because it's so nuanced and there's so many other components, right? That you could have one piece of software that's relying on 100 different sets of libraries from different providers, that any one of those libraries that could have a vulnerability now transcends into the underlying code itself. And I think it's a very tough game to play. Not to say we shouldn't do anything, right? Because I think that's the wrong answer. We just say, throw our hands up, white flag, that it's too complicated. Let's not do anything.
I'm out.
There's got to be something.
But I'm going to call on one thing you said first, which is, you know, that you both mentioned, the representative testing, the red rabbit approach, really does bring in the risk management mindset where you set enough of these out there to allow for enough testing to be confident that it is meeting objectives without doing 100%. And you have to figure out where your risk appetite is for that. And I think that's reasonable because 100% is just in anything, 100% is inviable. It's financially inviable. It's physically and time inviable. So doing the risk management is really the only way to go. Now to come to what you just said though, Eric, to talking about the idea that we have, we have all of these third parties, we have all these libraries, we have all these things included. I think that because we use all those and saying, we just can't, it's too much, that's a cop out. I think it's can't a defeatist allow
attitude, right? Yeah,
I think it's giving up. It's saying we don't have, that starts to move into the area of negligence. Then we're taking the things in, we know they're risky. But it's too hard. Putting it on the too hard pile isn't an option. But then I think it also then bodes the question of, do we change our development styles? Do we change the technology we're using to use all these libraries, especially, and I'll of course wander into the privacy space, wander into these places where we have no idea what the data is, what they're using data for either, let alone the security of it. And now we come back to, if everybody's using this particular API to do this particular thing, now we're all vulnerable or we're all not vulnerable. And so I think there's a lot of elements to this that mean we need to change our entire development assembly line.
Right. Yeah.
But just say, too many libraries, too hard. I think we've done that to date, and that is what has gotten us into trouble.
Certainly. Certainly. Yeah, I'm not advocating we throw up the hands and do nothing. Not by any means. I'm really interested to come out, and I'm sure somebody will pick this information out at some point. I would suspect that they were doing annual, if not more frequent, pen tests. And if you look at the core of their business is developing those tools on, was that something that was ever tested, that was going to be a capability or an inroad and something they potentially knew about as a potential weakness.
Yeah, and I think too, like what you just said, from a pen testing standpoint, it reminds me, you know, when someone says, why do we have to test this, you know, for a crash test, or why do we have to worry about this? It's a one in a billion scenario, right? Like every star would have to align for this one bad thing to happen. And the answer always was, well, what if it happens that one time, lives are at risk. And a lot of people could speculate, well, nobody's lives were at risk here. This was just espionage. Well, what happens though if this was a different style of an attack? You know, the point is that something came in unknown through the supply chain and made its way out into the environment of many businesses and government offices. And how didn't we know about this? You know, people calling for blood, right? Well, we need to have a reaction. You know, it's got to be equal and measurable. And it's, well, again, you know, like we talked about prior to coming on to do the episode was, is it an act of war or is it espionage, right? And I've read enough people's messages and online articles that most people would agree it's just a form of espionage. At what point do you say, well, this was an act of war? People got to take a good look in the mirror at our own country to know that we do a large amount of this. And when we look at privacy, Dan, and the conversations we've had around that, we've created these tools and our own government wanted Apple to put a back door in every phone so that, well, we could get in there in case something really bad happened. But if you make a back door, the back door is there for anyone to use if they can find a way in the back door.
Go back to Stuxnet.
Or just steal them.
We set the bar. Yeah. We set the bar on this whole game. This is our game that we set in motion. And then all of a sudden we're completely appalled when somebody's playing our game.
I totally agree there. And go ahead, Dan.
I was just going to say that I think this is a perfect example. You know, you mentioned the back doors. This is a perfect example at a perfect time as this is being actively debated in Congress. And I know we're about to see a new Congress, but this is actively being debated as to whether or not these things, these back doors should be forced in. This is the danger. This is the technology equivalent of the photo of the TSA keys. I don't know if you remember this. You know how the TSA, the physical locks are one of six unique keys and that's it. A TSA agent somehow got the keys photographed from and we'd have such good high photography that they were able to make 3D models of them, and instantly all six keys were available and anybody could, they were now done. That was in the physical realm. And we started using this as a discussion point as to why this should equally be bad in the encryption world. But now I think we have a much more tangible example of it's just that easy to get the keys for these back doors, and then everything is open. I mean, go back to our episode on movies, and it's sneakers.
Yeah.
No more secrets.
And I also want to point out too, though, like the way everybody, at least from the public's perception or point of view, the way we found out about this though, was because of a security company, FireEye, that found the threat actor in their environment, you know, stole tools that they use, and they immediately came out and disclosed that before they'd even understood where the attack came from. And as they found out more and more information and shared it publicly, they came through SolarWinds, and then this was a supply chain attack. There was definitely some companies out there that were ridiculing FireEye in the first days, the first 24 hours and 48 hours. And then it became very apparent that the sharing of information that they did probably saved a lot of companies or even government agencies. And maybe they were sharing that information internally with the government and immediately came out at the same time and they were telling the public about it. But I think you got to give some hats off to how FireEye handled it.
Certainly. Yeah, no. I mean, talking about setting the bar, I think they reset the bar on transparency and they did a phenomenal job. I think it'd be hard to call anything and say, no, they shouldn't have been so transparent about the tools that were touched and all of that. They gave us all enough information to understand what is now known by those attackers. Now, in the case of, we all suspect this was Russia probably knew about all, if not or most, if not all of those, right? But nonetheless, the transparency that they came forward with what happened, it's hats off.
Yeah, I would agree there as well. So I know we had the conversation before about backdoors, right? And why it's so not good to put something in there and the government pushed for them. And this is a prime example of now the government's got to take a good look in the mirror and say, well, we were the ones advocating it. This was probably the worst thing we could have done because look what happens when it got into the supply chain. But you look at the timing of it, right? You got a president on its way out, a new president on its way in. all this controversy and the fingers are being pointed towards Russia, right? And Eric, you said, what if, you know, the game plan for this was because of work from home, that now is the timing to go ahead and execute a few commands and start looking in on everything that's going on? Is America vulnerable? What if they were trying to get caught? What's the actual play at the end of the day? Or do we get lucky? I truly don't believe in luck.
Right. But it's such a tough one. It really is. Because you go back to one of the things you were saying earlier, right? It's the magician's trick or whatever, that, hey, watch what I'm doing over here. I'm going to do something here. Well, that kind of happened anyways. That, hey, everybody was so laser focused on, we've got to keep Russia out of the elections. So we were focused on that, right? That was top of every headline. I mean, that was, you couldn't turn on the news without hearing some element of that, and going back 4 years and the involvement and all of that. And I think that created the perfect scenario. But if you go back, and we go back to the HBO special that was talking about kind of the disinformation, distrust, you know, and kind of dovetailing that with the social dilemma, is totally fits into the Russian playbook. Totally does. That you create this confusion and focus, that everybody is laser focused on this one thing. Okay, I got them playing over here. I'm going to go after what I'm really after. But to your point, you know, it's like Inception. Are we three levels deep? Was this another one? And is there still another level yet to come? It's hard to say. That's the scary, but awesome part of information security.
I mean, Stuxnet had 5 0 days, right? The value to build something in with 5 is why everybody said that had to be a government or a nation state attack when Stuxnet happened, because that level of, you know, from a programming and a build standpoint and an execution standpoint takes a lot of time and planning. And that's what everybody's saying about this attack. And without being too speculative, obviously, I think there's more information that'll come out in the coming months, but it took 2 years to reverse engineer Stuxnet to say, and it's never been definitively pointed at two countries, but pretty much definitively pointed at two countries. And I feel that's kind of what's happened here. It's all fingers kind of point that way, but we don't have, at least publicly right now, a fingerprint to say that it was 100% nation state X or Y or Z.
I think the crazy difference here, though, if you think about it, Stuxnet, the government knew, what a government, some governments or conglomeration of governments knew of 5 0 days, right? They were holes in code that already existed. This one, a new 0 day was created in the code for them to use. There's nothing like being able, well, I don't need to use somebody else's 0 day. I'll create my own. That's completely different. I mean, I don't know if this would have necessarily been on a lot of our radars, right? You know, Dan, and we're talking about the risk equations. We've looked at some of our, you know, software packages across the company, and we anticipate breach, right? What if our ERP was breached? What happens there if it came into the code? I don't know if any of us have really taken a look at, what if my security tools are the one that got breached? I mean, it's, everything's on the table now.
Well, to parallel it back to COVID, I think many people said, oh, if we have mass outages or if we have to send people to work from home, that's fine. But nobody really did the risk planning for a pandemic in which they had to do this combination of, you know, this is the 500 years flood in both cases. COVID is the 500 years flood. SolarWinds is the 500 years flood. It's all of the things you thought about multiplied and in new and interesting ways that didn't fit the risk equation, which then says, do we need to reevaluate the risk equations that we use? Or do we need to expect that the 100 years flood is no longer good enough for our planning purposes?
Right. Well, it's kind of
metaphorically,
back to,
of course,
it's kind of back to Brian's kind of drawn the parallel to looking at crash tests, right? It's that worst case that yeah, we just realized that, all right, on the 10 years, the last life year of some product, in the worst case scenario where a semi is coming at you, that's the risk that we just realized, and how's it going to perform?
Right. I guess the flip side then is, did the risk model work exactly as it was supposed to? And in risk models, you do accept that risks will happen. You do accept that bad things will happen.
Right.
So you say, Our risk model was we're going to use known technology. We're going to use the same provider as these other models. We're going to save some money. As other Fortune 100s, we're going to save some money. We're going to not have to do this analysis. We save five people in a GRC team by only buying other known good tools. Maybe it was worth it. Now this is the part in which we take the side that we don't necessarily agree with or don't necessarily, but maybe it all played out perfectly to the way we thought it would. We knew something bad could happen and it did, but the net result of savings, of efficiencies and other things was totally worth it.
Right. Well, and I think it also talks to a bunch of our processes that we've built in to handle and respond to some of these responses. Look at the number of companies, you know, as we look at a bunch of us on different chat rooms with other CISOs and whatnot, that quickly, it's like the network DVR. We're able to quickly play back. Yep, we have an our environment. Here's the IOCs that came out. Yep, not it. We don't have to worry about it. I mean, that in and of itself, our ability to be agile, be able to respond, be able to look back over that time frame and say, not an issue for me, it does speak volumes. We were poised to respond to this very well.
Yeah. And it also reinforces the adage that you now have to plan. It's not if you get compromised, it's when. And your key metric will be the way in which you respond. The preparedness you are to come back from it, to deal with it. And you look at FireEye, they did a great job at coming back and being, you know, crystal clear transparency. They knew they had a game plan. You know, they were a victim in this. And I think they did a yeoman's job, at least from what we know and see now. And I think many of us did the same things with our customers and with our executives and, yeah, you know, and I think those are all indicators that we're focused on good response and not necessarily on the mythical achievement of 100% security.
I want to leave you with this thought, and I'm not leaving you with this, but putting it into your heads. So
ready, it's Brian's lead up to the mic drop moment.
This is referring back to the idea of the art of war and the principle meaning winning whole, right? In short, you use all your advantages to exploit your enemy's weaknesses. Having used your spycraft to detect such and attack in a manner that breaks the enemy's will by balking their plans, preventing the junction of their forces, and by avoiding sieges and open battle in the field. Hence, to fight and conquer in all your battles is not supreme excellence. Supreme excellence consists in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting. So hence the final word in the supreme goal of winning whole. So I look at this and you talk about a time when work from home, 2020 has been a very trying year for several different verticals, but IT not necessarily being one of them. If anything, things were being pushed out faster. And if you were already in there, end of 2019 and this pandemic hits, you know, you're set up pretty good that everybody's worried about something else. And then to have a view of what all the different forces are doing economically and so forth really plays directly into the art of war, right? So even though this was espionage, it's using that information very calculative. What is the end goal? Was the end goal just to have a lot of information? You know, tactically, what could it be? You know, at the end of the day, though, you know, one of the purposes for us getting on and having the conversation is not necessarily of how do we avoid this? How do we, like you said, Dan, be more prepared? One of the other quotes that I thought was very interesting was making lots of decisions will not guarantee you victory. It may not even improve your chances of not being defeated. It's the idea of the general who wins a battle makes many calculations in his temple ere the battle is fought. So what we were going back and talking about, looking at preparedness, the idea of Red Rabbit, coding, everything else, is taking a different perspective in how we are releasing, you know, new updates, how we're building products, right? Like the security companies themselves, are they really that much more secure just because they make a security product? And I say that working for a security company who makes a product. I think there's going to be a more focus on this, you know, a bigger focus in the future of when you're doing RFIs or RFPs, that inflection of saying, rather than just asking, what does your product do? What do you do as a company?
Yeah, certainly. I certainly could see greater transparency coming out of product development. You know, we're talking about the code release process and all of that. I think there is going to be a lot greater transparency coming out of a lot of vendors on how the sausage is made and how you don't have to worry about that process impacting your environment.
I like how we just pivoted over to food as well, because I look at one of the biggest changes in cattle production being the change from grass-fed to corn. And what most people don't realize is because there's a multi-stomach inside the cow, that if you change the diet of the cow in the last 14 days, even 7 days from corn back to grass, you'll remove over 90% of the E. coli buildup. But being on that corn diet produces levels of E. coli unseen in other animals that have a grass-fed diet, right? So where am I going with this? Multi-stomach locations. When we look at the idea of Kubernetes, microservices, the ability to break down production so that production at scale and DevOps and everything else, you have all these different locations. But changing the diet in one area could have an upstream effect that we don't know about. And it's switching back to that previous diet of inspection, et cetera. And it's one of the reasons why we had so many different E. coli outbreaks, because the processing plants became very few. It went from hundreds of processing plants down to about 14. So these cattle were coming from all over, large amounts of E. coli buildup because you weren't sure who was on a grass-fed diet or a corn-fed diet. And then the way these slaughtering things worked, it was just exposing everything to everything awful, right? I'm not saying that's how current DevOps production works, but when I break down the change to the sausage factory, if you're not buying it directly from the processing plant, but you're buying these sausages, you expect that the sausage you're getting is good, that there's an FDA, everything's been tested, it's good. And then when something bad happens, it's like, well, where did this come from? Well, if you take it all the way back to the source, there's only 11 of these plants, you know, just like some of the software companies, you have 11 huge big guys that are supplying everybody.
Right.
How do we know a little E. coli didn't get in there?
Right. And then spread across everything.
The parallels you draw, Brian, are absolutely amazing. we're going to gain listeners just on that, just to see how many different things we can draw back to security. And that was good. That was really good.
The next question I'll have for people too, when I'm talking to them and they bring this episode up, be like, what'd you think about the slaughterhouse analogy? And be like, I didn't catch that. Oh, so you didn't listen all the way to the end.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
The quiz question comes from the last piece of the education session.
But I thought this was a really interesting topic to talk about, and I think it's going to be talked about for, you know, several months going forward.
It's interesting. I mean, if you look at our process, why did we choose SolarWinds? Was SolarWinds the greatest product out there? No. There were certainly some better, but from a price perspective, a cost perspective,
yeah,
they hit the right point. And that's why so many different companies went with them. Well, how many other times have we used that same rationale in our decision-making? What other vendors fall into that same element of risk that we need to be looking at?
Yeah, and you make a great point there, because I think whether you're talking about software, whether you're talking even in pharma, metals industries, right? It's when you're trying to A, survive under a budget, right? And I think there's a ton of security practitioners out there that live in a budget that maybe it was their security budget, or maybe it's an IT budget. And as part of that IT budget, you get this portion called security and people pull from that. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you're reporting up to a board and the board cares about the products that they're making. So we've had this conversation about understanding the business that the company you work for is in. You know, like if you work for a manufacturer, if you work for a service company, you work for a pharma, doesn't matter. That board cares about, you know, their production, their revenue, et cetera. And there's been a lot of times where they look back and say, well, by buying this product, how is it going to improve our bottom line?
Right. Well, it goes back to knowing the business and spending the money where it has the biggest return and protects, has the biggest impact to risk on the business. And to Dan's earlier point, you know, I think SolarWinds kind of fit into that calculated risk that there was a trade-off.
It was fit for purpose. It did what it was supposed to well at a reasonable price point. Why wouldn't people buy into it?
Right. By the way, kind of tangential, did you ever, you look at the code that was put up? And it was a red teamer that had code that went through, iterated through the SolarWinds database and pulled out all the credentials. We ran that, and I was pretty astounded at how much in perpetuity is kind of held there. It does not purge data at all.
Yeah. Then back to the idea that as soon, you know, once it's written, it'll never necessarily disappear fully.
Right. It's continually learning about your environment.
And I've heard different articles say, like, so how do you recover from this? And it's burn it to the ground. Like,
well, that's the full recovery. Back to risk. Yeah. Good. Sorry. Continue.
Yeah. No. Please get, you know, like,
no, as I say, that's the parochial answer. Yeah. And if you want the 100% assurance answer, and even that isn't even 100%, but but the reality is we can't go nuking our entire network every time something happens. The business, I can't remember who said it. Oh, Eric at the beginning, our customers continue to demand and expect that no matter what happens, we're going to continue to deliver product. We're going to continue to support the things we have and provide software technology updates and, you know, keep the all plates spinning, no balls dropped.
Right.
And you really can't do that while spinning up a parallel network. It's also not cost effective. And which is better, a company that has decided its risk, that has looked meaningfully and fixed the places they need to and understand they've taken on some risk as well, or one that has gone completely out of business because they spent every last shekel nuking and rebuilding their system and being down for 7 months.
Right. And I think there's got to be some realization that there is a heightened level of emotion when these news headlines come out, right? Liz, if we timeline this out and we look at SolarWinds, this was an unanticipated entry point into companies. Yes, 100%. But if you look at the IOCs and the way this played out, the tactics that were used past that point, we've known about those. Go back to the MITRE framework. Those are pretty common. We've got controls. We've got visibility into those. So if you can, like any good IR kind of playbook that you're going through, if you can say, all right, yes, I know the entry point, but all of the other pieces that I was watching for somebody to gain a foothold, for somebody to exfiltrate data. And if you can answer the question and say, no, those were not hit, then why would you go back and say, well, just, I'm going to nuke it. It's not worth that time. I mean, I'm not saying sure. If you're looking for 100%, I want to get rid of this. I want to start over. If you've got that time, go for it. Nuke it. But most companies don't have that type of time. And think about it. You know, and one of the things that worried me about it is, so we caught wind of this, I believe, Sunday night as the news was breaking and we took it offline. Well, think about that move too. You take it offline. What is SolarWinds doing for you? It's watching up. It's monitoring. It's watching uptime on the network and things. Did you just create another black hole? Is that the exact response that was wanted, that you took down the cameras? I get to go play over here now.
And that's a great point. I remember having that conversation, you know, about what this hand's doing over here. Is that what the end goal was? Is that what they wanted us to do? One thing I was going to throw out, and I'll have to gather more information. This was one of the articles I was reading, but in regards to Supernova, apparently there are some different techniques in that MITRE is going to update in their framework that currently aren't listed in their framework, which I thought was really interesting. But I hate to be quoted on that because I read it. I should have tagged it. I'll go and find that and share that with you guys.
That wouldn't be surprising at all. And that makes sense. And actually, if they do that, I think that gives even further more credence to it, that we don't live in this hubris that we came up with all of the different components that could be in an attack. And that's what it is. That's all it shall ever be. You know, it becomes kind of a living, breathing thing. I think that's a really good response.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that is perhaps not a popular point, and we'll finish up with this, is the fact that Yeah, I guess I'll tell a story. I'll do a very poor imitation of Brian and make a make an analogy. But mine's a little bit harder to jump to. So bear with me. I worked for a Dutch bank, and I was younger in my career, and I was struggling with trying to figure out how to take a vacation. Americans were not so good at taking vacations, and a friend of mine based in Amsterdam said to me, Dan, you're not that important. The bank, the company has been here long before you. It will be here long after you. Surely you don't think that you are what is holding it together. It was something that really encouraged me, one, to take vacations. And I have done so ever since and meaningfully detach. And I come back very, very happy. But the analogy here is that also not every one of our businesses is so important that they are going to be looking at our stuff. I know we all want to think that we're that important. I know we all want to think that we are the target of state-sponsored attack and espionage. But the vast majority of us are not. And so take your measures accordingly. Make the right choices knowing. Now, if you're in critical infrastructure, if you're in the places that truly are interesting, trust me, you know you are. You know you're interesting. And you know you're there, and you know what you need to do. But for the rest of us, we're in industries that are interesting to us. They're interesting to our shareholders, but they're probably not interesting to foreign nation states, or not as interesting as we hope that they would be, or that our own egos let us think that they are. So put that into your calculations, and be reasonable in the way you respond on these things. And with that, it's time to sum up another episode of The Great Security Debate. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Brian. Wow, what another another fun time. You know, you don't really get to an episode in which you include Sun Tzu, cow stomachs, and various other and airbags all in one place. But thank you so much. If you're still listening, please go into your podcast app and subscribe. It really does help us out a lot. Leave a rating, leave a comment, leave feedback for others to find. We really want to hear your feedback as well. So please email us feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. Message us on Twitter @securitydebate. We'll be back soon with another Great Security Debate. Until then, on behalf of Brian Schneebly and Eric Willey, I'm Dan Ayala, saying so long for now.